This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening, everyone. It is Wednesday, November 6, 2013. After a wonderful lecture by Dr. Alan Mincer last week, we are now ready to at least have, to start our discussion on electricity in Jewish law. And when I first gave this, I subtitled this New Technology, Old Halacha, because this is, why we give this series on current Jewish questions at all. You're dealing with things that they didn't have in the time of the Talmud. All right, let's rephrase it. Electricity existed in the time of the Talmud. Electricity as we know it today to power appliances did not, right? So how do you apply it to today? When you have new technologies, right, how do you apply the old law to something that clearly did not exist? And the obvious answer is that there's a huge dispute about just about everything. Because not only do you dispute what does the Jewish law say, but you can also dispute what is this thing that you're trying to examine. So that's why I found this to be particularly, interesting. At the very beginning, we'll speak a lot, initially on the question of Shabbat. And we'll do that for, the first 3 weeks. And for the fourth week, we'll get into other issues that can kind of get overlooked. But Shabbat is probably the case where you have the most number of questions, or at least these are the most number of questions that I get. Can you use this on Shabbat? Can you use that on Shabbat? What do you do with lights? Yada, 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 and all that stuff. So we'll start talking about it a little bit today. For those who were not here last week, we'll do at least a brief summary. First off, did anyone have any questions on what was said last week? For those who didn't listen, if you're listening, go back and listen to Dr. Mincer speak about it. Otherwise, I'll just summarize here from the Wikipedia entry that electrical conduction is the movement of electrically charged particles through a transmission medium, a conductor. The movement of charge constitutes an electric current. The charge transport may result as a response to an electric field or as a result of concentration gradient and carrier density, that is, by diffusion. The physical parameters governing this transport depend on the material, which, by the way, was pretty much what Dr. Mincer said, only he explained it a lot more eloquently than Wikipedia. Go figure. The big question that comes up with electricity on Shabbat is that of an incandescent light bulb. And here you've got a nice little picture about how that works, also courtesy of Wikipedia. The main thing that we need to focus on is what we have as number, it looks like number three, I suppose, that tungsten filament. What happens? You've got electrical current that goes through the wire. That, it says here, an electric current passes through a thin filament, heating it until it produces light. Boom! There you go. All right? That's your typical incandescent light bulb. So we're going to have some discussions about that in terms of, is to what extent? I mean, because this is the big question. And the thing that we're going to discuss today is the relationship between that and actual fire. And we'll discuss in greater detail over the next couple of weeks. But first, let's talk about the fire argument, in particular with the incandescent light bulb. I believe next week we'll talk about other forms of light bulbs, such as LEDs and fluorescent lights, because they do operate differently. But here, let's look at the classic example that people were first dealing with. The incandescent light bulb, electric current passes through. You got to think of metal in the middle that the current makes it hot, glows, bam, you got yourself light. But you might also have fire. So, what exactly is the problem? Start us off with source number one.
Okay. Do not light a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day.
Pretty explicit right there. On Shabbat, you're not allowed to... You're right. This is the only malacha on Shabbat that's explicitly written in the Torah. Right? We've got 30... Like, you don't have in the Torah, don't tie a knot on Shabbat. But you do have don't start a fire. And see, I won't even do the Billy Joel reference. That's what my standards are for the Munster. Right? Okay. So right off the bat, it is a biblical prohibition, a biblical violation to ignite a fire on Shabbat, which we tend to think is pretty bad. given the ramifications. Jamie, take the Gemara in Brachot 41a.
Rab said they taught that it is permitted only to temper the water, but if it is to harden the metal, it is forbidden to heat the metal. Whereas Samuel ruled, even if to harden it, it is still permitted. If the primary purpose is to harden it, can it be permitted? Rather, if stated, Rob said, they taught this only where there is merely a sufficient quantity to temper it. But if there is enough to harden it, it is forbidden. Whereas Samuel maintained, even if there is a sufficient quantity to harden it, it is permitted.
All right, so there's a discussion here. And I think, well, they may not have had specifically electricity, but they knew what heating metal was. And in fact, there was even an understanding in the time of the Gemara of heat conductivity, of when you, like, if you stick in, let's take a wooden spoon. Why do people use wooden spoons? It doesn't conduct heat well. You stir up a wooden spoon, like, the spoon part gets hot. The handle does not. Whereas what happens when you leave a solid metal spoon in something hot, or if you take a metal rod and you put it into a fire, eventually, heat conductivity, the whole thing becomes hot. There was an understanding that fire makes metal hot. All right? I understand that's, you know, a very elementary way of putting it, but there's certain, when you have old, you're talking about old law, people try to look back and find, well, do we have any analogous laws on the books? What do we have that's similar? So if you're talking about heating a filament, well, maybe that's an issue here. So there does seem to be a discussion about heating the metal, right? The only and there happens to be a dispute between Rav and Shmuel on this particular issue, but note that there's something there. Shalamis, take the Mar Shabbat.
Son of Rabbi
Avira.
Avira said, "He who throws a tent peg into a stove is liable on account of cooking, but that is obvious. You might say his intention is to strengthen, harden the article. Therefore, we are informed that it first softens and then hardens. The fire heats the moisture in the wood, which softens it, and it is only after it evaporates that the wood hardens.
Mm-hmm.
This prior softening partakes of the nature of cooking."
All right. So to explain a bit about what this whole thing with intention is about, anyone want to take a stab at it? Okay. So in order to violate Shabbat biblically, you need to have what's called a melechet machshevet. You need to have a certain intentional act. It's not just that you do something, but whatever you do, you have to mean what you do. And there are a whole bunch of details that we might get into in another class about how Shabbat works. But know that a melechet machshevet, an intentional act, is required. So to say certain things are prohibited. And here it says here, you know, throwing something in a stove is obvious because it's, you know, bishul, because you're actually, you know, chayav mishum mevashel, because you're actually cooking it, is a particular concern. And the issue is, if you're cooking it with the correct, proper intent, that is a biblical prohibition. If you're not, then it wouldn't. All right? And there is a dispute about what that means, but I can certainly tell you that people have used that as a way of being lenient in a whole bunch of issues. The distinction on melechet machshevet of an intentional act was the basis for the conservative responses on driving to synagogue on Shabbat. That's somewhat convoluted and about way beyond the scope of this. But at least know that they did kind of discuss it, and it is important to know that even if you want to say that something's fire, you have to think about, is it an intentional act? So let's assume that it is fire. Would you say turning on a light switch is an intentional act or no?
Definitely intentional.
Explain.
Because you want the light switch to be on when you want the light to be on.
More than that, explain in greater detail about how the light bulb works.
So, well, the light, I mean, how a light bulb works, well, that deals with, obviously, the whole tungsten filament and all that stuff, but I'm not sure how that relates to the intent part. I'm missing something.
Well, I would argue, like, again, simple thing here is that, well, you want that metal to get heated,
mm-hmm,
because that's what gives off the light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not talking here about heating it for making it hard or making it soft,
mm-hmm,
right? That's not your concern. Right, you're passing through current such that it gets heated, because if it doesn't get heated, it doesn't turn off, it doesn't give off light, and if it doesn't give off light, you don't really have a very functioning light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Kind of similar. Something to keep in mind. Here's another issue. Risa, this is Gemara Shabbat 75a.
Rabba and Arzera both say that any action which completes a forbidden action is obligated on the grounds of hitting with a hammer.
I'll replace that. Should be. I'll switch this to prohibited. All right, hitting with a hammer. That goes in quotes. In Hebrew, you call it makeba patish. Right. One thing that's prohibited on Shabbat is completing a prohibited act. Right. Kol midei de'it bagemur melacha. It's very important to note that. Right. According makeba patish means you have to do something that completes something that is forbidden. Example: this coming Shabbat, we'll be doing a siyum on Masechet Shkalim for Daf Yomi. Doing one page a day, this Shabbat, we're finishing off the tractate of Shkalim. Now, technically, I just completed something, right? It's like, oh, you're not allowed to finish a tractate of Gemara on Shabbat? No! That's not makeba patish. That's, you know, no one's going to argue that. It's kind of silly, right? Very important to realize here, it's kol midei de'it be gemar melacha. It has to refer to, like, the completion of an act that is otherwise prohibited on Shabbat. That is another reason that people will offer in terms of electricity, particularly because of the circuits, right? Because when you flip the switch, right, there's like a metal plate in the back, and we'll talk about this more in greater detail, that you're completing the whole circuitry. That's how the light bulbs get the electricity in order to turn on in the first place, right? So let me ask you this. Any initial thoughts or intuitions about whether or not that would constitute makeba patish?
Well, it's completing. I mean, the idea of completing seems weird because it's like, it seems to me, if you're playing online, you're starting. Whatever you're doing, you're starting it. Mm. It's not like you're
the electric current still's like going through there.
Uh-huh.
Right? Just like stopping at a certain point because there's an end. Like, uh-huh, it's not actually being used. So I would say this. One, and this was an argument given to me by my first computer science mentor. Mm-hmm. When I was first learning computers, his name was Sean Nolan. I worked at Information Builders. Really, really wonderful place to work. And we would, you know, he would ask me a bunch of, like, Jewish questions. And one of them was, you know, about electricity. And I tried explaining this concept about completing a circuit. And he asked me, well, how do you close a door? Because when you close a door, you're completing a wall. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, brilliant question there. So that's something you should all keep in mind. Mm-hmm. But more to the point, it would be a problem of makeba patish, according to this Gemara, mm-hmm, only if the action itself would be prohibited, right? Is it a gemar melacha if you're completing an actual, you know, melacha on Shabbat, one of the categories of work on Shabbat? But then you have to say, well, what category of work are you actually finishing, right? Just to say makeba patish, you're completing something. Well, what is it that you're completing, right? Completing the building of a circuit? Well, are you doing that? In which case, how would it not be like a door, right? Because you could easily argue that a light switch, you know, you're not really completing it when you flip it on because the whole thing is intended to be open and closed, mm-hmm, right? It's finished when, you know, you pay off your contractor. That's when he completed the malacha, right? It's supposed to be, it would almost like being and people actually do discuss this about certain types of retractable awnings, right? Because it's intended to open and close. That you'll even find in the Ribiyat book. Anyone know what the Ribiyat book is? All right. Slight digression here. Published by Feldheim, there's a 4-volume box set, it's gray, uh-huh, called The 39 Malachos, written by this guy Ribiyat, that is incredibly comprehensive and occasionally hilarious. Like, the body is one thing, and all the footnotes are in Hebrew. Uh-huh. And one of the hilarious points actually came up with that for an unrelated. Uh-huh. He said that an awning attached to a building is fine to open and close. And he also said umbrellas are no good. And he said, even though it seems that, you know, based on the reason that we gave for awnings, the reasoning for an umbrella should be fine, our sages have already decreed that it can't be done, and one may not trifle with their decisions. And I'm like, you know, when you're writing a 1,000-page, 4-volume book, I expect a little bit more analysis than just, you got to do what the great rabbis say. If you're writing a short book, fine. But you're going into details. You're acknowledging that you're not being consistent. Like, just say so. There are also a few other things there. Anyway. Okay, so that serves as a nice little introduction. Take number 5.
One who ignites even...
I'm sorry. I keep doing this. I pass off without actually saying what it is. This is Rambam Hilchot Shabbat 12:1.
One who ignites even a small amount. Does it matter what small amount of what?
Hamavir kol shu chayav, meaning any amount of ignition. It's like, it doesn't matter whether or not you set an entire forest on fire or a small little match.
Okay.
Right?
But anyone who ignites even a small amount violates the Shabbat, provided he does so with the intent to collect the ashes. However, if he ignites for the purposes of a destructive act, he is exempt because he is destroying. Someone who heats metal so it should be tempered in water has violated the biblical prohibition of lighting a flame.
Okay, so to explain another thing here, is that one of the intentional acts that you need in Shabbat for biblical prohibition, not rabbinic, for biblical, is it must be a creative act. All right? Now, let's say writing. Writing is a creative act. One of the prohibitions, though, is erasing. How is erasing a creative act? When you're taking something away, it's when you're erasing such that you should be able to write. Building is a creative act, but demolishing such that you should be able to build is also a creative act. All right? So here makes a very important distinction here. Setting a fire, according to Rambam, is only biblical if you do so with the intent of collecting the ashes. All right, continue. With the Ravad.
Yeah. And why is it not because of the prohibition of cooking, as in the case of throwing a tent peg into a stove, which softens and hardens, or heating the ember to temper in water, which is not considered extinguishing, but it is hitting with a hammer?
Right. So he makes a distinction between, you know, in terms of cooking the tent peg, that he, according to the Ravad, it's a matter of makeba patish, right? Because by putting it in the oven, you are actually, you're making it, you're cooking it in a way that you're completing the action of, like, making the tent peg a tent peg, right? Whereas here, as other cases, it need, like, you have to do it to collect the ashes, and gives the example of heating metal so that it should be tempered in water, right? You violate the prohibition of lighting a flame because when you do that, you're actually, you know, they're creative, it's a creative act. Right, you're not just like you can burn metal to destroy it. You can also burn metal in order to make it better. Right, you forge. Right, steel becomes harder when it's forged. Y'all know that thing. All right, so stop here for a second. How do you think this is analogous to lighting our tungsten? Or would you consider that a creative act or a destructive act?
Creative.
How so?
Because you're creating something. You're creating light, or not, I mean, creating light, but you're certainly increasing the amount of light. It's certainly, I like this way, I don't see how it's, maybe a better way of putting it is, I don't see how it's destructive.
Okay. Thoughts?
That's what I was going to say. How would it be destructive?
Well, let's say you have a light that goes on, it stays on for a while. Mm-hmm. At some point, idiomatically, we say your light bulb has burnt out, in which case, you are getting benefit from the destruction of this tungsten filament. Right? You're not using it, you're not sending through the fire so that you should create something else. You're sending, you know, whatever through it so that ultimately it becomes burned out. See? True. It's tricky, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
But your ultimate goal, your intent is not to burn it out. Your intent is for that intermediate stage of the light.
Yeah, but that's the intermediate stage. Ultimately, it's more of a destructive act than a creative one, though.
In a way, you're kind of destroying it. Because...
Or if anyone here is a fan of Schumpeter, you know, creative destruction.
Yeah.
Anyone know about that? It's an economic term. Similar type of thing. It's actually a very interesting term because you do get that from Shabbat of creative destruction. Just like in economics, you know, some businesses go under to allow other industries to survive. Yeah, that's creative destruction. Yeah, you've destroyed some companies, but other companies grow. You know, the analogy is perfect for Shabbat. Yeah, not many people get to quote Schumpeter in a Shabbat year. Anyway, so those are a few things to keep in mind. Gemara in Psachim 41a talks about other things in terms of heat sources that we're going to need to think about in terms of whether or not electricity is fire. Rav Chisda said, "He who cooks food in the hot springs of Tiberias on the sun of the Sabbath is not culpable. If he boiled the Passover sacrifice in the hot springs of Tiberias, he is culpable. Wherein does the Sabbath differ that he is not culpable? Because we require the product of fire, which is absent. So this gets into a much more complicated question of, how in Jewish law do we define fire? Right? Previously we were talking about, well, just shoving stuff into an oven. Right? So we know like what a flame looks like. Mm-hmm. Remember Dr. Mincer avoided scientifically defining fire. Mm-hmm. We'll actually, you know, give a definition in a bit. Right? But it does get a little bit complicated. It's not just heat. There's a discussion here of at least the hot springs of Tiberias are not considered fire. Mm-hmm. Now, take a Gemara. This is a Gemara Shabbat 9. What did I do here? Sorry, it's Rambam Hilchot Shabbat 9:3.
Okay. Someone who puts an egg in a warm cloth or in dirt or ash that is normally heated from the sun, even though the egg is cooked, the person is exempt because the derivative of the sun is not the same as derivative of fire. But the sages restricted it due to its derivative of light. Similarly, someone who heats food in the hot springs of Tiberias or the like is exempt. Someone who cooks on light something which has already been cooked or something which does not need cooking at all is exempt.
So the operative thing is that first thing here. If you wrap something up and you have it heated by the sun, it's prohibited not because it's toledat ha'or, but not because of toledat ha'esh. Meaning, in terms of how it's considered cooked, basically, if you cook an egg on a stone, like kicking an egg on a sidewalk during one of those hot summer days that we had this past year, you haven't actually violated the normal sense of cooking because it wasn't really done with fire. All right? Now then the question is, would electricity itself count as fire when you're heating that tungsten, that piece of tungsten?
More like the sun, in other words, which is not fire.
Exactly. Because, I mean, normally, like, it's hard to find a real halachic definition of what's considered fire. But keep in mind that we have other heat sources where it is sufficiently different that, I mean, don't forget, the thing that you get, the way that the tungsten filament works is that it's the electric current that gives off heat, and it's the heat that causes the light to glow. Mm-hmm. But not all forms of heat are considered fire, right? Mm-hmm. Just cooking it up, even being heated by the sun, isn't considered fire.
Although here it seems like there's a restriction on cooking with light, too.
A derivative there, at least, yeah. I mean, it's a much, much longer discussion that is going to get a lot more complicated. But yes, mm-hmm. But even so, is electricity visible? Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes, I mean, not in its own right, but you're not cooking it with, you're not heating it up with light, you're heating it up with subatomic particles. Mm-hmm. Or atomic particles, I don't know which. Well, I guess either
one. Whatever.
Things that you and I can't see.
Yeah.
All right? Okay. Even with my glasses.
Uh-huh.
All right. So that's a spin. Now, this is one of my favorite pieces that I got added to. Dr. Mincer led with this last week, and I promised it was in the source sheet, and here it is. This is a wonderful story from Richard Feynman, who is a Nobel laureate, and this is in his book, Surely You Must Be Joking, Mr. Feynman. This is a story of him going to the Jewish Theological Seminary about being asked regarding electricity. Jamie, start us off with this.
While I was at the conference, I stayed at the Jewish Theological Seminary, where young rabbis, I think they were Orthodox, were studying.
Which, by the way, is really funny.
Yeah.
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 Since I have a Jewish background, I knew of some of the things they told me about the Talmud, but I had never seen the Talmud. It was very interesting. It's got big pages, and in a little square in the corner of the page is the original Talmud, and then in a sort of L-shaped margin all around this square are commentaries written by different people.
Let me also point out here, a lot of this stuff has nothing to do with our topic, but this is really entertaining, and it's worthwhile going through the whole thing. Yeah.
The Talmud has evolved, and everything has been discussed again and again, all very carefully in a medieval kind of reasoning. I think the commentaries were shut down around the 13 or 14 or 1500s. There hasn't been any modern commentary.
Well, in fairness, you can laugh about this, but he's not wrong. There's a certain point where people, how to put this, like culturally just don't like arguing with people who came before them. So you do like meta-commentaries. You're not commenting on the Talmud as much, but you go through all of the medieval commentators first, and it has to be done in that vein. Mm-hmm. So you can laugh. It's like, wait, there was no more commentaries on the Talmud? you know, technically there might have been, but he's not wrong that the approach to things had changed. All right? So we'll cut him a little slack here, all right?
Talmud is a wonderful book, a great big potpourri of things. Trivial questions and difficult questions, for example, problems of teachers and how to teach, and then some trivia again and so on. The students told me that the Talmud was never translated, something I thought was curious since the book is so valuable.
And it, yeah, whatever.
One day, two or three of the young rabbis came to me and said, "We realize that we can't study to be rabbis in the modern world without knowing something about science, so we'd like to ask you some questions."
And I have to stress that it's this type of question that is why we give these classes, that they realize that. It's something that Rabbi Tendler used to yell at us about, even though we took his class for that very reason, right? You can't really be a rabbi in the modern world without knowing the science of the modern world in which you live, because you can't make halachic discussions without knowing what you're talking about, all right?
Of course, there are thousands of places to find out about science, and Columbia University was
right
near there. But I wanted to know what kinds of questions they were interested in. They said, "Well, for instance, is electricity fire?" "No," I said, "but what is the problem?" They said, "In the Talmud it says you're not supposed to make a fire on a Saturday. So our question is, can we use electrical things on Saturdays?" I was shocked. They weren't interested in science at all. The only way science was influencing their lives was so they might be able to interpret better the Talmud. They weren't interested in the world outside and natural phenomena. They were only interested in resolving some question brought up in the Talmud. And then, one day, I guess it was a Saturday, I want to go up in the elevator, and there's a guy standing near the elevator. The elevator comes, I go in, and he goes in with me. I say, "Which floor?" And my hand's ready to push one of the buttons. "No, no," he says, "I'm supposed to push the buttons for you." "What?" "Yes, the boys here can't push the buttons on Saturday, so I have to do it for them. You see, I'm not Jewish, so it's all right for me to push the buttons." I stand near the elevator, and they tell me what floor, and I push the button for them.
Let me also say something. You know, the boss lived in a neighborhood with a lot of Jews, and he had mentioned about, you know, the guy standing in there to push the buttons. And he asked me, quote, "Isn't that cheating?" It's one of the reasons why I love, like, those type of questions. You really get at the heart of, you know, what the questions are. It's like, yeah, like, so this person's doing it. Yeah. Continue.
Well, this really bothered me, so I decided to trap the students in a logical discussion. I had been brought up in a Jewish home, so I knew the kind of nitpicking logic to use, and they thought, here's fun. My plan went like this. I'd start off by asking, is the Jewish viewpoint a viewpoint that any man can have? Because if it is not, then it's certainly not something that is truly valuable for humanity. Yak, 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 yak. And then they would say to me, then they would have to say, yes, the Jewish viewpoint is good for any man. Then I would steer them around a little more by asking, is it ethical for a man to hire another man to do something which is unethical for him to do? Would you hire a man to rob for you, for instance? And I keep working them into the channel very slowly, very carefully, until I got them trapped. And do you know what happened? They were rabbinical students, right? They were 10 times better than I was. As soon as they saw I could put them in a hole, they went twist, turn, twist, I can't remember how, and they were free. I thought I'd come up with an original idea, phooey. It had been discussed in the Talmud for ages, so they cleaned me up just as easy as pie. They got right out.
Yeah.
Finally, I tried to assure the rabbinical students that the electric spark that was bothering them when they pushed the elevator buttons was not fire. I said, electricity is not fire. It's not a chemical process as fire is. Oh, they said, of course, there's electricity in amongst the atoms in a fire. Aha, they said, and in every other phenomenon that occurs in the world. I even proposed a practical solution for eliminating the spark. If that's what's bothering you, you can put a condenser across the switch so the electricity will go on and off without any spark whatsoever, anywhere. But for some reason, they didn't like that idea either.
All right, so stop here. This is one of the questions I asked Dr. Mincer last week, because the way that he was describing, you know, electricity, is like, well, there's electric force over. And he said, well, technically, yes. So here, Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate, he's a really brilliant, brilliant man, says quite explicitly, electricity isn't fire. It's not a chemical process as fire is. And even though there is electricity amongst the atoms in a fire, the same is true with, you know, all, every other phenomena across the world, right? That's a pretty big deal. Now, there's a difference, or at least a very important difference, between a scientific definition of fire and a halachic definition of fire, right? And this is where things do, in fact, get complicated, right? Dr. Mincer didn't want to say electricity was, said we don't have a halachic, we don't have a technical scientific definition for fire. Here, Feynman seems to think it's because it's not a chemical process. Maybe. I mean, I am not going to venture into the science world to say whether or not it is or it isn't. right? But it is, I think, fascinating where you ask a guy who knows it and he gives you a straight answer, it's not fire. Maybe it makes a difference, maybe it doesn't, right? Simply because it could be, not from a scientific perspective, but it could be from a halachic perspective, right? Make sense so far? Okay, any questions? All right, so I think next week we'll get to a little bit more of the details here. In terms of right now, intuitions about whether or not electricity is or is not fire from a halachic perspective, where do you think you hold, percentage-wise? How much percentage for and how much against?
Well, I'm having a little bit of... I guess I'm kind of working backwards here. I guess the whole time I'm sitting here is kind of like, well, I know I can't use electricity on Shabbos, so somehow it must kind of eventually come to that. It's like watching a movie in reverse.
Yeah, well, that's where you got to come to the other classes. Because, yeah. I mean, look,
well, I would plan to.
When people, well, like I keep saying here, if you want to say you can't do it on Shabbat, you have to, the burden is always on the person who's telling you something's obligatory or something is prohibited. And the burden has to be, you can't use it on Shabbat, you have to prove why. Now, if you want to say, well, it's our custom, we don't do it, like, that's a little bit easier to say. But if you want to say, no, it is a matter of Jewish law that it cannot be done, and you're not relying on the laws of custom, well, then you have to prove how you're violating a biblical or a rabbinic prohibition, mm-hmm. right? Which means you got to show, the burden is, show that this action, in fact, is precisely what the sages were talking about. Or at least you provide some textual support or evidence for that. Mm-hmm. So just to say that you know you shouldn't do it, well, there are lots of reasons why you shouldn't do things, right? But there's a difference between saying something shouldn't be done and something is halachically prohibited from being done, right? That doesn't mean you do everything that's halachically permissible, right? Because there are going to be gradations. But if you're going to use that technical term prohibited, well, yeah, it's a pretty big deal right there.
So, I mean, if in that line of thinking, then from all of this, I would say that it doesn't sound like it mm-hmm. should be prohibited.
Well, at least also, something else should mention here. The question of fire is something that either has to address any form of circuitry or the specific case of the incandescent light bulb. There are plenty of things that we use that don't use an incandescent light bulb, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The fluorescent lights work very differently than the incandescent. We'll speak about that next week. Your clock radio probably doesn't have anything incandescent in there either, right? So I wanted to start with the most obvious case behind it and to at least introduce the question of fire, right? So if you're going to say, you can say, well, regular electricity isn't, but I think the incandescent light bulb is, that could be a possible option, right? Or at least from what we've seen so far.
Other than the light bulb, would any other form of electricity work that way? I mean, I would think...
What do you mean?
I mean, like, I would think a television or a stove or a refrigerator, none of them use the tungsten like a light bulb.
No, well, it depends. The old monitors... I see, this is one reason I love doing this. I get to, like, go old back deep. So y'all remember the big monitors? Oh, youngins, let me tell you a tale. So, today, all these newfangled flat-screen TVs were pretty much LCD monitors, the liquid crystal type things where mm-hmm. you got pixel by pixel and every now and again you'll have a dead pixel that doesn't quite light up and all that. Back in the day, your typical monitor was a CRT, which stood for cathode ray tube, where it would like send these particle things to the screen. Mm-hmm. This was back in the day, what you probably have heard what a screensaver was. So the reason why it was called a screensaver was that it automatically produced a moving image on the screen such that you wouldn't have, quote, burn-in. Remember seeing these old machines? If you had one of these old CRTs and you just had the exact same thing up on there and you let it go for a while, that would be burnt into the screen and it would never go away.
That was an issue with plasma TVs when they first came out with the channel logo, mm-hmm. right? Like the little channel logo on the bottom right, it was burning images.
There you go. Had
TVs.
The burn-ins. Exactly. Yeah. So there you could even make a distinction there between whether you had an LCD or whether or not you had a CRT monitor. Today, CRT monitors are, it's nearly impossible to find even if you'd want to. But yeah, So now, when you have, like, your computer comes with a screensaver, you know, that's one of those anachronistic vestiges of, like, days gone by, when you actually needed to save your screen. But since the LCD monitors, each pixel works independently, you don't need to do that. So that would be a non-incandescent light bulb example of something you might want to consider. Mm-hmm. See, it's good being a geek. What are you, Jamie? Any thoughts?
I don't think it's going to be halachically fire.
All right. Anything or including the incandescent light bulb?
Not sure.
All right. Shalanis, any thoughts?
Well, I think it's contributing to it's heat, so it's like it's with a light bulb. It's like it's like fire because it's lighting up.
Different than the sun.
Different from it is different. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's using it's.
Well, here's
well,
a good.
It's very,
well, here's a good reason why you could argue it's different than the sun. Mm-hmm. Whereas the sun, it's reflective. This is internal. Meaning, well, I guess no, because you're heating it so from... Well, you're still heating it from an outside source here. The electric current is getting passed through the tungsten, and that's what's causing it to heat up, which might be considered as something more fire-like than doing it even, you know, leaving something out in the sun directly. Could be.
But the sun and the hot springs are a natural source. Versus electricity is something you
yeah, right.
You could argue electricity is natural too.
To me,
we're just able to harness
it. Not turning on a light switch.
Well, but the electrical force. I mean, we're just harnessing stuff.
Versus and lightning.
Let's not forget. Let's say you've got a hydro dam, right? The water's still going. You're just using that hydro power to create something. Is that considered natural or not? Clean energy, all natural.
I mean, to me, the sun. You're changing. I mean, not the sun. The light, and this is what makes it at least. Stronger case with the light, with the electricity, you're changing something. Whereas the sun, it's like the crock pot that you turned on before Shabbos.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to be there no matter what. You can't change it. Whereas you're at least sort of changing it with the light bulb, even in a way that I can't really explain coherently.
Reese, what do you think?
Is it different turning on a light bulb versus turning on a radio?
Maybe. This is only week one. Right? So, because this does get complicated, I wanted to at least lay the groundwork for some of the premises. The answer is, people argue about this. And we're going to see their arguments, and we're going to see why, and who says what. Is there anything definitive about this? Probably not, simply because we don't have a Sanhedrin that can legislate it explicitly. You not only are going to have the arguments on Jewish law, you're going to have the arguments about how does this electricity fit in Jewish law. And even just from what I've offered, you can have a lot of plausible arguments how it's more like this or it's more like that, and that will determine what sort of prohibition you're under. Right? So, look, people, I mean, spoiler alert, have said that electricity is in fact fire. Also, people who have said no, that's an incorrect assumption.
With a light bulb, I can understand that, but with, let's say, the cell phone, it works differently. It's not the...
True. There are also going to be other halachic issues in terms of what you're using it for that are independent of electricity. For example, hashma'at kol, right? Doing certain things that cause a certain noise on Shabbat. Mm-hmm. Notice some people won't use door knockers on Shabbat. Because of the noise that it creates. So that could be a reason why you don't turn on your radio, regardless of whether or not electricity is fire, right? It's not purely an electric matter. It's what do you do with that electricity? Remember, that's kind of how Dr. Mincer explained it last week. You know, electricity is always there. What we're able to do now is use it, like harness that power to have us do things with it, right? If I had, you know, an electric-powered, I don't know, machine gun, I wouldn't be allowed to shoot people with it. Forget the electricity, because I'm not allowed to shoot people, right? I don't know if such things exist, but that's...
Just generally or on Shabbos?
Well, both.
I mean, but if it was allowed generally... Now, there's a question. If it's allowed generally...
Don't laugh. We're actually going to get to a similar logic like that when we get to gambling. That's not for a while.
Okay.
But the point is, like... Certain things you wouldn't be allowed to do even if electricity wasn't a factor, right? So you could say a radio could still be prohibited even if it wasn't electric somehow. And I don't know what else would be. So that's an important thing to consider as well.
But there's different reasons for those.
Because there are different prohibitions,
right,
that'll come in. So, exactly. So that's why, you know, it shouldn't be extrapolated to, even if you say, well, electricity isn't fire, that doesn't mean you could simply extrapolate to every single use of electricity. Look, if you have an electric oven, right, and you use it to cook something, at the very least it would be, you know, rabbinic or something like that.
Right.
Cooking.
You're still like
a separate problem. Are we going to get into more detail on that?
Of course. This is only week one. This is a unit.
Yeah,
we've got a few more weeks on this. Next week, we're going to get a lot more into that discussion about what's what and a little bit more with the details and see what we can do with that. Week three, we'll do a fascinating comparison, I believe, with Rav Moshe Feinstein, where we're going to spend the entire class going through two of his responsa to show just how complicated it is. And the last week, we'll talk about examples of electricity in halakha outside the scope of Shabbat. And I'll see that it has a few other interesting ramifications, or at least outside of purely whether or not you're violating Shabbat. All right? Have a wonderful night.